Welcome to Talk Mental Health with Logan Noon. I got a great episode coming up for you here. I have on my friend, my colleague, someone who I consider a mentor, Bruce Deckard. This person is a therapist. He has really over 30 years experience working in substance abuse treatment. His real specialty in my eyes is kind of family wellness and how using family dynamics you can improve, hopefully improve, someone's substance abuse problems. I've really looked to him for advice throughout my career, or my short career so far as a pre-med student. I think you guys are really going to enjoy this one. If you can, if you're enjoying this podcast, if you've enjoyed the children's book that I just did, I would greatly appreciate it if you could leave it a rating, whether that's on iTunes, whether that's on the Amazon store, doesn't really matter to me. But the more ratings that I get, the more people that I'll be able to reach with all of my efforts. If you enjoy my work, that would mean the absolute world for me. Thank you so much and enjoy this episode. All right, Bruce, you're officially on Talk Mental Health with Logan Noon now. Welcome.
Thanks, Doc.
Bruce Deckard?
Yeah.
Deckard, yeah. So I've known you 4 years now, at least. We met while working at a treatment center, and now I'm a student at this treatment center, and it's been great to kind of have this mentorship over the years. I've really enjoyed our daily lunches together. Now I finally got you on my podcast. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you. It's nice to be here. It's nice to be part of something that you're creating and reaching out to a community that I think is definitely looking for more understanding right now.
Yeah. So can you paint a picture, 30-second picture, roughly of like who Bruce Deckard is, like for the audience? Like what are you doing now and like kind of...
Yeah. So I'm a family therapist. I work in a treatment center, residential treatment center, with adults. Addiction as primary and certainly coexisting comorbid. My history has been over the last 46 years hanging out in mental health field, working in addictions, mostly also in schools doing drug counseling. And raising a family, and and we got a little farm right now, and you know, just working out of communities, and I just believe a lot in my work. I also have a small private practice, so that kind of keeps me fresh on that end too.
Yeah, well, very cool. I've done a lot of episodes. You're going to be my 74th, I believe. But quite frankly, one thing I'm a little bit ashamed of, I've talked a lot about mental illness, but I haven't done that much on addiction. So I want to get some more episodes of people who have overcome addiction or live with addiction, whatever verbiage you want. But also I'm excited, like you're a specialist in addiction and a therapist. So why did you choose addiction to specialize in rather than being more broad with all mental health conditions?
Yeah, and actually I kind of think that when I look at people with the disease of addiction, I also believe that there's a lot of mental health components to it, that it's not as separate as people might think, that oftentimes there are co-occurring conditions, especially anxiety, depression, bipolar, and other conditions that are not as always diagnosed and treated appropriately. And so it, you know, it manifests as people using substances to the point of a lot of negative consequences, a lot of struggle in relationships and work and legal issues, and then ultimately in addictions. And when we tease it out, it really lines up a lot with the mental health field. And I only wish that people going through school and looking at careers would be able to get more education and understanding of what the field of substance use disorders and addictions is about, and how to really understand it better so as to be able to really tease those out when you're diagnosing and treating.
Yeah. Well, I guess we were kind of, you asked me before we started, like, who's listening, Logan? And I was like, I don't really know. But I guess for that person who is listening, who's maybe considering a career path similar to yours, what would you tell that person is like the most gratifying experience of being an addiction therapist, but also maybe the most challenging aspects too?
Yeah. Well, I like to start with the more difficult, because once I get that over, then I can play a little, right? So when I think of the challenging part, it's really, you know, given that this has been 40-some years, I've watched the field of addictions treatment and mental health as well open up a lot more. And the challenges early on were the stigma that was greatly out there for a while, much more than it is now, and also the lack of treatment. Mm. And over the years, being able to really advocate for treatment, not only addictions, but also mental health, and looking at how mental health moved into the communities, community-based treatment, and then, you know, really looking at addictions, especially as we've addressed the opioid crisis and recognizing how comprehensive that is, and really helping people understand that there's so much to it, and it affects so many people, mm-hmm. and which means families. And so, you know, this parallel process of looking at not only the individual but families has allowed us to really address some of those earlier struggles, and especially the stigmas, and begin to educate the community. The part that I love the most about this, that just rocks it for me, and the reason I'm still doing it, and I'm an older guy, not younger.
Yeah, we're not filming today. Yeah. One or two more gray hairs than me.
Yeah. But anyway, at age 65, I have had so much fun, because I know that I can't change a person. Mm-hmm. You know, as a therapist, people say, oh, I'm going to see my therapist and they're going to help me do this or do that. Well, that's not my role. My role is not to help people, because I don't think people are helpless. Mm-hmm. And I get really jazzed when people want to seek help, because it tells me they want change in their life. And so that's like the gravy. That's like, okay, now we're moving. You know, and it's exciting and it's hopeful, and I see people change even in the few weeks that I might work with them in residential, and for my private practice I see people for a much longer period of time, but I see the change, and mm-hmm. and they are certainly there to not necessarily continue in treatment, but to take what they gain from treatment and move it into their own realm of self-discovery and moving their lives forward. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of exciting, and I love that part.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you kind of highlighted, I feel like, my favorite aspect of mental health care, maybe also the hardest part of mental health care. It's like the family kind of component. And that's what I really like, your approach to your practice. We talked about before we hopped on, like, I almost view mental health conditions as very different than like a heart condition. Because a heart condition, I argue, would not lead to a divorce necessarily, but severe anxiety could lead to a divorce, kind of thing. And I just think that a mental illness can affect so many more people than just the person that lives with the mental illness. And so I know family wellness is a big approach to your practice. So how do you incorporate like family dynamics into helping solve an addiction problem?
Right. So it's really... you know, again, because addiction is a family illness, and I also think to an extent, and that's very individual, that any mental health conditions affect family, right? So, mm-hmm. so like with addictions, it's all about the family understanding what it's about. And unfortunately, with addictions, oftentimes there's a component of secrecy and a breakdown in trust. Mm-hmm. So that really kind of splits people and creates, you know, a real distance. Mm-hmm. When I think there's mental health issues, certainly family members don't understand it at first and need more education and understanding of what that's all about. And if they don't, they continue to struggle with the behavior related to the illness, mm-hmm. just like with addictions. And so it's really about, you know, with families and, let's say, addictions, it's all about getting them into the parallel process of understanding education, and almost like you have to do an intervention on family too, because
yeah.
they're caught up in that struggle of trying to fix the person with the disease of addiction,
mm-hmm.
and they can't. They're powerless over that individual. And so, you know, I look at how can they begin to take care of themselves while learning more about what is addiction and what's their role in recovery,
mm-hmm.
and really developing their own recovery program themselves,
mm-hmm.
so that they can be there in a more healthy way to support their loved one as their loved one wants to move into recovery.
Yeah, yeah, certainly, certainly. Well, so what I want to kind of, one thing that really excited me about addiction treatment, but also sort of frustrated me, is like AA. I thought AA was wonderful. My role working at the rehab center was I would bring individuals who had already went through our program to a bunch of AA meetings. That was probably 75% of my efforts. And I almost wish that same equivalency existed in my world, quote unquote, of bipolar disorder. You know, when I would go to these bipolar disorder support groups, it would be groups of typically 7 to 10. Sometimes we'd have meetings as big as 30 people. Whereas with this, I'd go to AA meetings sometimes with like 100 people, 150 people. And it was such a wonderful network to meet people. But then on the other side of the coin, and that was wonderful, on the other side of the coin, it seems like AA is kind of like the big gorilla in the room. And there's not other as large options for individuals to have that peer-to-peer support education in addiction. So I guess what is your opinion on all of that kind of like peer-to-peer support?
So, you know,
the I didn't realize you liked me that way deal, because it's one thing to receive McDonald's, but an entirely other thing to know that they woke up early to face the world and bring you McDonald's breakfast still hot in the bag.
Appreciate you.
There's a deal for every morning. Now grab two loaded sausage burritos for only $3. Prices and participation may vary. Single item at regular price. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. To show you how easy it is to file a claim with Geico, we hired a nature show host.
In the native habitat of a suburban driveway, the poor victim of a broken windshield is left assessing his vehicle, utterly helpless.
Well, not true. If he's got Geico, he can file a claim online, over the phone, or with his handy mobile app.
But like a lone gazelle, he'll suddenly be left to fend for himself, awaiting his terrible fate.
Nope. Geico will assign him a designated claims team to help him out, too.
So the gazelle gets his car fixed and everything.
Wow. Nature is so cool.
Geico. Great service without all the drama.
When I went to my first AA meeting, 1974, I was doing the same thing you were doing. That was driving people to meetings.
Yeah.
While I was in school. And, you know, I was just beginning to learn about what addiction is. And when I got in there, it was like I saw the excitement that people had about being together.
Mm-hmm.
And I started to recognize early on that there was a sense of hope when they were together. It was like non-judgmental. People were like supporting each other being at the meeting and being sober,
mm-hmm.
and just being healthy. And so I found that intriguing, and I found it kind of sexy, because it allowed me to recognize what are the benefits of this. And so I, you know, I equate it to the research that was done in England around the Rat Park study, where you know, they looked at, you know, one guy said the opposite of addiction is not recovery. The opposite of addiction is connection.
And okay.
I've started to learn more about over the years and identify what I saw early on but couldn't put into words.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really about connections.
Yeah.
And so when I think of these groups, group therapy is the best way to treat
mm-hmm.
addictions on a clinical level, and I would guess in a more mental health aspect, in group therapy, it can be very effective as well. So I see the benefit of not only a clinical piece, but also this focus in AA on connecting.
Yeah. Yeah. No,
answer?
I think that's a good answer. And you know, I would have this conversation a lot with guys who were struggling with the whole kind of AA thing, and I would kind of equate it in a sense to church. And I'm atheist, so I kind of come at this from a weird perspective, but it's like, you know, AA, a lot of individuals have come to me and say they struggled with it because they were atheists, and there's like under God or, you know, different kind of God components to this. But I would always say you don't have to follow everything exactly perfect, 100% perfect. You know, you don't have to believe necessarily in the God components of AA, but if you take a step back and just realize what that community can give you, and just introducing you to so many other people who lived similar experiences to you, deal with similar components to you, is the best thing in the world. And I struggled with my mental illness, bipolar disorder, for a long time in isolation, and it wasn't until I found those social groups that I kind of felt more normal, like an actual human being.
Right, so you related to those people, right? So you could see that there were other people just like you with this mental health condition who were also functioning in the world. And whether you were, you know, feeling good or struggling on any given day, you could see others doing the same thing. So it kind of normalized the condition, right? And it made it like, all right, I'm not alone.
Yeah.
And it's working. And I think with addictions, it's the same thing. You know, when people say, oh, are you a friend of Bill's, which is the reference to, you know, understanding and recognizing that Bill W. was one of the co-founders, and that says, oh, yeah, we're both, in, you know, recovering. And so you hear people immediately connect, and then they don't feel judged, and they feel like a part of a bigger picture, and that is recovery. So there's a sense of hope in that, isn't there? Like when you connect with other people that are similar, and who can understand, relate, and not judge.
So you mentioned stigma earlier, and I know, like, you know, addiction is technically defined as a mental illness now, but it seems to be like there is still some differences between viewing addiction versus viewing mental health. And I would almost argue there's different stigmas associated with depression versus being an alcoholic kind of thing. Do you see any differences there, or how would you define the stigma between the two?
So over the years, it really is, you know, it's like a lot of biases or isms, you know, like racism, where you look at something that is different and you generalize it to a population. And so then that develops a stigma, a certain interpretation. And when you find people that think the same way you do, then it kind of compounds that, you know, that stigma. And unfortunately in society, because there was a lot more mystery to mental health issues and there was a lot more negative behaviors around addictions, because it becomes the hijacked brain, and it really takes people out of doing things as rational, and people who follow social standards, it then created almost fears and a judgment of people who struggled with addictions and mental health, then creating a greater stigma. And it was a lack of education and understanding for quite a while, and it required a lot of work. And I think the mental health industry did a lot of work in the 80s to change some of that stigma, and actually did a lot of education of communities and trying to get even in schools people to understand more about what mental health issues were, and that it wasn't about crazy people. It was about people with a condition that presented a certain way and was treatable. With addictions, I think it has taken time, especially as the medical community has begun to understand how this is a brain disease, mm-hmm. and they've done a lot more research, brain studies, on what addiction is, and they've been able to carry that message out further into the communities, mm-hmm. and normalize it as this is unfortunately a part of people's lives, and it is treatable. So mm-hmm. what do we do about that? And instead of continuing the stigma, do more on education.
Yeah. So I want, before we get to like 2020, because I almost want to finish with that. So, you know, you started your career, what, in like the 80s, 70s?
74.
74, okay. So, you know, I of course wasn't even alive then. I was born in 89.
Whoa.
But I know, dating myself real bad here. So, you know, 74, I imagine the world and addiction treatment looked, alcoholic treatment looked somewhat similar. I know we have different meds now and all these different things, but there was still quite a bit of alcoholism in 1974 and in 2020. And I know we're moving away from the term alcoholism. I should use, you know, alcohol use disorder. Or either way, I digress. But so that somewhat seems to be the same. But, you know, if we look at opiates, like what part of opiate use was your practice in 1974 versus kind of like the changes we've seen evolve over the last, you know, 40 years? Like, what else has kind of changed?
Sure. You know, one of the biggest things that I see is actually, you know, that there was the term alcoholic versus the term addict. And there was a differentiation there.
Okay.
And a lot of it had to do with behavior and the substance of choice, right? Mm-hmm. And it was interesting because the old gendarme of alcoholics didn't want addicts in AA meetings.
Hmm. Watch it, you're covering your mic real quick there.
You go to NA meetings, you don't come to AA. If you have a drug addiction. And they didn't even want people going to AA if you took any kind of medication.
I remember hearing about this. Psychiatric medication you referred
Correct.
To. Yeah.
Correct. And so, as prescribed. And so, you know, the old saying was, you know, you don't need medication, you just need to don't drink, go to meetings, call your sponsor. Mm-hmm. And that was the way it was for many, many years. And now as we learn more about what addiction is, I am really of the belief that it's not about the drug of choice. It's about changing the way we feel. And it's a brain disease that creates addiction. And whether it's alcohol or a bump of cocaine or a spike of heroin or sex or shopping or food or mm-hmm. whatever it is, when we're feeling uncomfortable, we try to find something external to treat. Mm-hmm. So I look at it more as a kind of a general view as opposed to specific to the substance. When it comes to the opioid disorder and heroin disorder, I look at, you know, years ago, I can remember, you know, people were seen as much more seedy and dark when it came to heroin addiction. Mm-hmm. And I think the behavior back then was not understood, and it was seen as, you know, so...
I haven't really woken up until I've had my McDonald's breakfast deal. And I know this is true because before breakfast, I put my phone in the refrigerator and couldn't find the keys that were already in my hand.
Nothing gets the morning going like the first sip of an iced coffee. Get any size and any flavor for 99 cents until 11 a.m. Price and participation may vary.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. McDonald's, I'm loving it.
Family. It looks a little different for everyone. For some, it's mom and dad. For others, roommates who feel like family. And for others, it's your significant other, their golfing buddies, your children, a high school soccer team starting lineup, and oh look, they're all taking you up on the offer to stay for dinner. Really testing the limits of that phrase, the more the merrier. But no matter where you call home, GEICO makes it easy to bundle and save on home and car insurance. Easier than making three frozen pizzas and assorted frozen veggies into a cohesive meal.
Actually depraved, And there was, you know, they related a lot more theft, burglary, and perhaps even violence with drug addiction as opposed to alcohol, which was mostly, you know, if you got caught drinking and driving, the cops would drive you home. Mm-hmm. Or some, you know, somebody else would get you out of the car and they'd drive you home. So now it's a much more across the board. Addiction is addiction. We look at it, you know, yeah, there's a different drug of choice and some manifestations of differences within that whole field. It comes down to brain chemistry and what needs to be treated and what's going to be most effective.
Yeah. Well, and I feel like we're breeding, culture, these kids who are just going to almost be more prone, I think, to that addiction pathway. You know, because I look at, like, video games or even cell phone use, those, like, quick dopamine hits, however you can achieve them, whether it's killing people in Call of Duty or, like, some stupid game, Candy Crush on your phone, or then, of course, like, social media, how many likes you get on this photo or whatever. I just feel like we're breeding this pathway even more than the children that started, you know, when you first started your career, when there wasn't cell phones. So it makes me, like, incredibly nervous for the future at hand, that, you know, these individuals, these kids growing up in this society are going to be more prone to addiction.
Yeah, I think there is that immediate gratification piece. I think that has manifested, unfortunately, as a result of those generations above you.
Yeah.
Above you only in the sense of, you know, just older generations that created a certain way of looking at the world and kind of thinking that I can have whatever I want without having to work for it. Mm. And I think that has permeated down through different generations, which then fits into that whole piece with substance use.
Yeah.
Because that is about immediate gratification and changing how we feel. And I think the world today is a lot harder to live in than it was when I was a kid growing up. And I think that creates a lot more stress and anxiety. But I also think as adults, we didn't do a good job of recognizing how to teach kids how to deal with those things.
Yeah.
And so as a result, there's a look to find ways externally to change how we feel, whether it be an iPad or a phone or, you know, a game, you know, whatever those games are.
Well, I just think about how, you know, I'm a big proponent of meditation. I didn't even really learn about meditation until I was in the psych ward and diagnosed with bipolar disorder. Like, why wasn't this concept of meditation introduced significantly earlier? You know, because I of course didn't have mania growing up, but certainly symptoms of anxiety. And I think so many kids have symptoms of anxiety. And I hope it's different now.
Yeah.
Hopefully by reading my book, these kids can understand meditation. Little bit of a, you know, had to throw that in there.
Right.
But you kind of had a nice segue, though. Let's now talk about kind of, 2020, like the perfect storm for kind of like substance abuse, you know, people living in isolation, dealing with that tremendous amount of stress and anxiety and unknowns moving forward. And, you know, maybe you know some stats that I don't. I don't even know if the stats are necessarily fully out. But I remember I did a presentation in medical school that talked about how the unemployment rate was correlated to substance abuse, overdose, and suicides. And so I don't know if like the final studies are out yet since we're in the midst of this pandemic, but it's obviously having tremendous impacts on substance abuse. So how do you think coronavirus has impacted substance abuse?
Yeah, I think what I have heard, mostly subjective narrative and less statistical studies so far, because again, like you said, we're early into this and I think we have a long way to go. Certainly when you look at the 1918 pandemic that hit this country, there was there was a lot of things that went on then, and it eventually turned into prohibition,
yeah. right?
Because I think there was an increase in alcohol use during that time, mm-hmm. and it changed how people responded to crises. Now, we know the world's changing every day, and you know, if we don't get on that bus, we're going to be caught in kind of the pull of where everybody else is going. And so it's on us as individuals and as society to really look at the changes and to understand what's happening now. And I think the whole COVID piece has kind of caught us short without having a good plan in place. And I think a lot of people didn't know what to do with it. And it did contribute to a lot of isolation and disconnect. Mm-hmm. And when you think of the opposite of addiction being connection, COVID has certainly disconnected people from each other and from what were their lifelines.
Yeah.
And we had to adapt and learn new ways to cope, which aren't fully developed yet. And we're still looking at ways we... Certainly, luckily, right now, we've been able to utilize the internet mm-hmm. to create virtual connections. And
yeah.
they're not, in my mind, they're not the same as in person like you and I are mm-hmm. right now, but they do provide something. And it has opened doors. And even though it's an uncomfortable and unfamiliar way of doing life, we still have found that we need to do it in order for this pandemic to decrease.
Yeah.
And so it's an adaptive behavior, and we need to learn more about it, we need to teach more about it, and we need to slow it down. Like you were suggesting, you know, things like we use in treatment here at the treatment center with mind, body, spirit, meditation and yoga and acupuncture and other things, it's really about a consciousness. And if we can slow things down and just be aware and not react to the feeling,
mm-hmm.
because when you think of the immediate gratification, if I'm uncomfortable, I want to change it up.
Mm-hmm.
But if I can just sit in the discomfort briefly, understand it, maybe just identify what it is, and then reach out to somebody virtually or family right there, or whatever it is, whatever resource we have, and understand that this will pass. It's like anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
It's there for a little bit, and it will pass. It's how do we manage it while it's going on?
Yeah.
And learning those skills, those coping mechanisms, and having a consciousness that allows us to be present and actually be more grateful and appreciate what we do have that is good,
mm-hmm.
and worry less about the things that are out of our control.
Mm-hmm.
And I think COVID has created some of that panic and fear, and you can see anxiety. You know, people are rushing to therapists virtually
yeah.
to just connect on about their fears and their anxiety and stress levels. And so if we can learn those coping mechanisms, including some of the mind, body, spirit stuff that you reference, it's going to be a different world. We're not going back.
Yeah.
We're going forward, and we got to create change, and it's going to happen anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think I think, you know, I've only been in this weird mental health space for like 10 years or so. I'm actually in May will be 10 years since I had my manic episode. You know, that's kind of a big special day for me. Kind of cool.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've seen the attitude towards mental health treatment, both substance abuse and, you know, mental health disorders, other mental health disorders, really change. But one thing that still frustrates me and motivates me to try to use my power as a future physician for the better, it seems like with substance abuse and mental health treatment, it only, or typically only really starts when shit hits the fan, when it gets really, really bad kind of thing. And it seems like in between, it's often missed or ignored by primary care doctors. So there was this one instance in medical school, I'll share this story, where I got yelled at by a professor pretty bad. But we had a patient come in, and she was saying she drank, like, I don't know, like one beer a night kind of thing. And I kind of pushed into her and grilled, and I was like,
Well, no, like how much do you really drink? Like, I won't be mad. I really need to know for my medical purposes. Because my opinion is a lot of times patients come in and underreport how much maybe they're drinking specifically to physicians, just because it's easier to ignore the problem or ignore that this could turn into a bigger problem. And then maybe they finally end up in a treatment center when things get really, really bad. So I guess, what is your attitude on that? Am I like, what do you think? How can we catch people before things get so bad?
Right. So, you know, students coming out of school, entering into residency and eventually your own practice or group practice, it's, you know, you whether you see people in your office or in an emergency room, you know, you do the evaluations and assessments to understand what's going on. And when it comes to substance use, it's not only what are you using, but how are you using it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can say to you, well, I only have one drink a day. It happens to be a 16-ounce tumbler with, you know, about
a shot of vodka after. Yeah.
Four shots of vodka with a splash of soda, you know, or whatever it is, a splash of tonic, you know. And so it's how do we look at that, you know, and then it's also the question is, why do you drink?
Yeah.
And when I ask people why
And that's never a question they teach us in medical school.
Right.
It's always how much do you drink? What do you drink?
Right.
Yeah, not why.
And the why is more
Okay.
So the why of this is really more like a psychiatric question as opposed to a medical question. Unless you're tying it in with other aspects of the medical exam, and then you start to see the connection. So the question, why do you drink? If I say to you, well, you know, when I have pain in my abdomen or my left knee.
Or to sleep even, I feel
or
like.
Yeah, to sleep, you know, because I've had restless nights a lot. It starts to connect with some of the other conditions that we see in the practice. And so then you start to understand what is the use about. That it's not just casual social drinking, it's really about medicating something. Then you begin to understand how that could change a person's use, and that eventually it could lead to an addiction. And I think the real key is in treating someone in your office.
We're gathered here today to join Mike and Jill in holy matrimony.
So they may file jointly this tax season.
And you are?
April from TaxAct, the tax filing software with the expert guidance to help you file for less and get more.
Works for me. So, Mike, do you take this woman to love, honor, and get her a maximum refund?
I do.
Jill?
Ditto.
I now pronounce you married, filing jointly.
I always cry at filing status updates.
TaxAct.
Switch to TaxAct today and start for free.
See TaxAct.com for details.
Now through February 16th, join a clean and spacious Planet Fitness for zero enrollment and only $10 a month. With tons of equipment and free fitness training, it's the perfect place for everybody to work out.
Even me, Mr. I can't sleep at night, so I keep dozing off during the day.
Especially you, Snoozy. You'll rest easier and feel fit-tacular.
Wait, how did you get in here?
Join in club or at planetfitness.com. Zero enrollment, $10 a month, cancel anytime. Hurry, deal ends February 16th. See club for details.
It's important to educate that you may drink socially or you may use it to fall asleep right now. That can change, and you never know when it's going to change. And when it becomes an addiction, when the brain switch flips and you go from a cucumber to a pickle, you can't go back, and it creates a very strong compulsion to have more, because now the brain is taking over as an actual illness, and it requires more to get the same effect. And that's really important when you look at, okay, so let me tell you about what alcohol or these other substances do in your body, especially when you combine things and when you try to treat a condition like anxiety or insomnia with an Ambien and a glass of scotch.
Yeah.
You know, when you start to educate people about this and making sure they understand where this can go.
Mm-hmm.
And if you talk them through and certainly do enough diagnostics to say, hey, I've noticed some things on your blood work that might indicate something.
Yeah.
You know, that's when you can start to do more education and help people understand the risks involved.
Mm-hmm.
And the progression of the disease.
Yeah, yeah. So I know a big portion of what you do now is, you know, you work in groups specifically with families. So what is the lesson you feel when you're working with families the most that you end up kind of teaching these families? So, like, what's one common theme that you say you always seem to address or address the most often with these families?
Yeah, it's, you know, for family members, there's a strong reaction to a person that is struggling with addiction, and it's usually fear-based, love and fear-based. And so their tendency, like wild animals, it's either get in and fight this, or it's run like heck the other way.
Yeah.
And so what I often see families doing is getting in there and trying to manage the person or control them or change them. And if in the education around what addiction is as a family illness, if we can work with families to understand what their role actually is, and that's to step back from their loved one who's struggling with the addiction directly and help the families learn how to take care of themselves, understand what addiction is, and how they can support their loved one, not by being the recovery police,
yeah,
but by really looking at what are some of their healthy boundaries as family members, what are they willing to allow in their life in terms of behaviors, and how they can support the treatment,
yeah,
of recovery.
Watch out, you're smacking your mic again. I like it, though, with all this passion you're speaking. It's wonderful. But one thing I find with that I really love about the world of psychiatry, we keep talking about families, it's like, I mean, the negative sides. You know, if someone's really struggling, it seems like so often the health of the other family members can really, really deteriorate, too. Just maybe through stress or maybe through their own negative coping skills, just to deal with this person. But you know, if we can, we as providers can make an impact, you can really change the whole dynamic of the family. And that's something that just thrills me.
Right. And I think as providers, you know, one thing that would be helpful when you start to tease out some of the information from your patient and recognize that there may be some issues around substance use disorder there, that you would also encourage them to see a therapist.
Yeah.
Because then it will allow the therapist to individually connect with that person with the substance use disorder and then also encourage the family to get the support they need.
Yeah.
You can always recommend family therapy or couples therapy because that's how it sometimes manifests.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, you may not be able to see the family, but getting that individual, the patient that you're working with, connected with a therapist would be a great start.
Mm-hmm. So you've worked with, you know, there's a lot of students listening to this show, right? So a lot of pre-meds, pre-nursing, hopefully some pre-therapists, but what, at least for medical students, what do you feel are skills or like areas of understanding that they lack that, you know, for me, is essentially me, like moving forward, like areas to focus on?
If students can change the narrative coming out of medical school to recognize that it's not a factory,
mm-hmm,
of treatment that you're moving into, an office where you just have rolling admissions,
yeah,
every 15 minutes, that this requires developing a connection, human to human first.
Mm-hmm.
Just being with a person to let them know that you're there, that you're connected, that you can support them, that you can treat them, that they can have some hope and trust you in some ways to create that connection first so that they feel like you're there with them.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like when a medical issue ends up in the emergency room and everybody that's there treating the patient is talking in grave terms,
mm-hmm.
because it's such a serious situation. And the patient looks up at everybody and says, "Hey, treat me like I'm going to live, not like I'm going to die."
Yeah.
And so if we can say, "I'm going to treat this person."
Enjoy basketball, soccer, and all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using bonus code CHAMPION and your first wager is risk-free up to $1,000. Plus, when you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, player props, and daily boosted odds specials. Download the BetMGM app today or go to BetMGM.com and enter bonus code CHAMPION and place your first wager risk-free up to $1,000. Now you're winning with the King of Sportsbooks. Visit BetMGM.com for terms and conditions. 21 years of age or older to wager. Washington, D.C. and Virginia only. New customer offer. All promotions are subject to qualification and eligibility requirements. Rewards issued as non-withdrawable free bets or site credit. Free bets expire 7 days from issuance. Please gamble responsibly. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-522-4700.
As a whole person so that they can be whole,
mm-hmm.
then I have to sit and just be with them a little bit longer than just let's get some vitals, let's get some quick assessment, and let's look at some meds.
Yeah, certainly. It seems like so many aspects of medical care are strictly by the numbers or strictly by what the physical exam shows, and that's really why I like psychiatry so much. It's so nebulous and, I would argue, more challenging but more satisfying too.
Well, I ask the question why a lot,
mm-hmm.
and when I work with people and I work with families. Well, why do you do that? Why is that happening now? Why do you think that they said this? Or why are they doing that? It tends to open up the story more.
Mm-hmm.
And it tends to bring a lot more rich material to work with to begin to look at what this crossword puzzle is really about,
mm-hmm.
you know, and to fill in some of the squares so that you begin to see a story develop. And when we can read the whole story, we tend to understand the depth of the issues more,
mm-hmm.
and what's the story behind the story. When we can just stop ourselves from having to talk or fill the silence with noise.
Yeah.
If we can just be present with people and hold space to just be human with them, it will allow us to see much deeper into those issues and be able to treat it more effectively.
Yeah. Well, and I like that last thing you said. There was, I remember, a vivid moment on my surgery rotation where me and the surgeon were about to disclose to this one patient that she did have breast cancer still. And before we even went in the room, she was coaching me about all this stuff, but the most important thing was on silence. She goes, "Okay, we're going to say this and then do nothing. Shut the hell up and not say anything. It might even feel awkward, but we're just going to shut up and you're just going to deal with it." And it was one of the best teaching moments. Yeah, and who would have ever thought, you know, this one physician, a surgeon, Dr. Amber Wooten, what a lover. She almost had one of the most profound impacts on me, who's going to be a psychiatrist, on how she dealt with patients and how using silence to create that connection that you keep kind of talking about so much as two humans, rather than this, like, just series of vitals and series of measurements and images. I think that's the most important part of care.
Yeah. And part of that, whether it's giving information or asking a question, it's allowing that piece to just hang in the air and not feel like you have to fill the space.
Yeah.
But that allow that person to be in that moment, even to say, "How are you feeling about what I just said, and allowing the person to be honest with you, it will give you so much more to work with.
Yeah.
And to understand about how to treat this patient going forward.
Yeah. Yeah, certainly. Well, Bruce, I've been talking to you for about 45 minutes. I think that's a good place for us to kind of wrap it up. If the listeners really love Bruce, you now have a private practice in Litchfield. That's where I grew up, so hopefully there's some listeners from Litchfield tuning in, and you know, you'll like Bruce as much as me if you're listening, I guarantee. So find him in Litchfield. Anything else you'd like to spew into the internet radio sphere?
I just think it's awesome that this is part of the world as it is today, that there are podcasts where people can learn and understand and hear different perspectives, because that's what I need, and I can tell you, the older I get, the less I know.
There we go. Yeah.
So the more I gotta learn. So yeah. Thanks for doing this.
Yeah, it's been great.
I haven't really woken up until I've had my McDonald's breakfast deal. And I know this is true because before breakfast, I put my phone in the refrigerator and couldn't find the keys that were already in my hand.
Nothing gets the morning going like the first sip of an iced coffee. Get any size and any flavor for 99 cents until 11 a.m. Price and participation may vary.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. McDonald's, I'm loving it.
Geico asks, how would you love a chance to save some money on insurance? Of course you would. And when it comes to great rates on insurance, Geico can help. Like with insurance for your car, truck, motorcycle, boat, and RV. Even help with homeowners or renters coverage. Plus, add an easy-to-use mobile app, available 24-hour roadside assistance, and more, and Geico is an easy choice. Switch today and see all the ways you could save. It's easy. Simply go to geico.com or contact your local agent today.